This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The Smithsonian's dinosaurs are back. After a five-year, $110 million renovation, the National Museum of Natural History reopened its beloved Dinosaur and Fossil Hall this year. It's the largest overhaul in the museum's history. The soaring exhibit is called Deep Time. It reflects a ton of new scientific discoveries, including our current understandings of climate change and evolution. But the centerpiece? The thing that may well bring out your inner 10-year-old like it did mine is a real skeleton of a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Later, we'll meet the woman who found that T-Rex. But first, let's go back in time. Deep time. 4.5 billion years ago, when the Earth was an unshaped blob of molten rock floating in space. Kirk Johnson is the museum's director. He's a paleobotanist who oversaw the renovation, and he gave us a guided tour. Shall we take a walk?
We shall.
All right, let's walk.
So we're going to walk. We're walking backwards in time now. If you come off the rotunda, you come in with the Ice Age. You can either go left into the age of the humans, or you can go straight backwards in time. We're going through the Cretaceous, and we just stepped into the Jurassic right now. Headed fast for the Triassic, then the Permian, then the Carboniferous, and we'll bend the corner back to early life. We've got a long ways to go because the planet's 4.55 billion years old, and the exhibit covers the entire story. So we just turned the bend.
How did this exhibit come about?
This exhibit originally opened a year after this building opened in 1910. There was an exhibit that came to be known as the Hall of Extinct Monsters. It had skeletons of whales and mammoths, and initially just one dinosaur, and over the years it grew and grew and grew, and they kept modifying parts of it, and by 2001, this place was so cluttered and so old, we knew we had to do something. So we decided to do a complete renovation, rip everything out, go back to the suds, and start to build a single 31,000 square foot hall called Deep Time. And we are, let's go a little bit more. We'll start at this rock.
While we're making our way over to the rock. How'd you get into dinosaurs?
You know, I am a guy who started by finding fossils when I was 5 years old. And the first time I found one, I didn't think much of it. The second time I found one, I said, hey, you can find stuff. It became my childhood secret power. I could find stuff. Coins, arrowheads, fossils. And so I started working around, reading books, going places, finding stuff. Started going to museums because that's where all the good stuff is. Started volunteering at museums and never looked back. Became a paleontologist, and now I'm watching this great hall open, a hall about the entire history of life on our planet.
So this has got to be like the World Series for you.
It's a good day.
Yeah.
It is definitely a good day.
Yeah.
Let me show you a cool rock.
So what is this rock?
It's a slice of a redwood tree. You can count the rings. There are 270 rings on this tree, so the tree was 270 years old when it died. But the tree is made out of rock. This tree died 15 million years ago. So those two scales of time, a 270-year-old tree that died 15 million years ago, is meant to start adjusting your mind right now, because you're entering deep time. You're entering our planet's history. And we talk in terms of millions of years, or even billions of years. It's not something you're used to talking about when you have a normal conversation, like, I'll see you for lunch in a billion years.
I was just going to ask you about the title of the exhibit, Deep Time. It seems like the whole structure, literally the structure of this hall, is designed to make you think, just in being in this space, differently about the timeline of all life.
Exactly. I mean, our Earth has a long and interesting history, and the spine of this exhibit is the timeline. So we're starting now. I've taken you really back to the very beginning. And the beginning is a pretty boring place. There's no life on Earth for the first billion years of Earth history. A billion years is a long time to wait for some slime to show up. That's what happened.
Now, why organize it as a timeline? You know, a lot of the galleries we see in natural history museums that have fossils, they just have cool fossils kind of organized by Cretaceous, Mesozoic, Jurassic, etc. Why do it as a timeline?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You do it a number of different ways. And for us, the timeline makes the most sense because the planet has a really compelling history, and time's arrow takes us straight back to the beginning. And what we find so interesting is that so many things change over time, whether it's evolution or extinctions happening or climate changing or different kinds of animals evolving. All these things happen on a march through time. And looking back from our present time, when we don't have a very deep view of time, this is a way to organize it that helps people think their way through our planet's history.
Which way should we go next?
Let's go this way. There's an early part of the exhibit where we talk about the basics of paleontology. How do fossils form? How do we date them? Where do we find them? How to become a paleontologist? How the Earth works? Big questions like that. This is a nice place to start, this big platter full of bones.
Now this exhibit, or exhibits like this, who is this mostly geared toward? Is this mostly geared toward like little kids who are still fascinated with dinosaurs? Is this for, you know, adults who are already kind of versed? Like, who's your target audience?
Anybody who's got any curiosity at all. And that could be a kid or a grandmother or anybody in between. People who still want to understand how the world around them works. And it's a complicated world we live in. So people that are like, hey, what's that? Tell me more. That's the people we're showing this exhibit to.
Is this part of the exhibit in terms of like how paleontology is done? I'm guessing this is the kind of a section of an exhibit that's got to be updated because the science is still advancing in terms of the technique.
It's true, but if you think about paleontology, it is a kind of simple science in a way, because give me a pickup truck and a pickaxe, I'll go find a fossil. And those are, you know, relatively primitive tools. But here's a picture of this guy with a little air scribe chipping the fossils out of the rock. And here are examples of insects in amber or fossil footprints or petrified wood, different kinds of fossils. And in front of you is this really incredible slab of bones. This comes from a site in Nebraska called Agate Springs. And what you're seeing is just a jumble of bones of little rhinoceroses that used to live in Nebraska. And somehow they ended up in this jumble. And the question is, how did all these bones get here?
When you say little rhinoceroses, how little are we
about
talking?
About hip height and about 6 feet long.
Like the size of a pony?
Yeah, pony-sized rhinoceroses. There's lots of extinct rhinoceroses that come in all shapes and sizes. But this is like one you'd probably have a nice pet in your front yard, a little junior rhinoceros pet.
A pet rhino.
Yeah. So here's the question, how did these bones get here? They're about 20 million years old, more or less. And what happened 20 million years ago to take a bunch of rhinoceroses, totally shake all the bones out, and pile up all the bones? And the exhibit is full of these little details. I'll show you one more around the corner here. This is one that I really love because I found it myself. This giant palm frond.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where do you see palms today? If you want to see a palm tree, where would you go?
Well, I'm from Florida, and I moved here from California, so that's two. Yeah. Hawaii.
Yep, good spot. Three, good.
Yeah.
I found this palm frond in Alaska.
Shut the front door. You didn't find this in Alaska.
I found it live on television in Alaska. There's even evidence of us finding it on Nova's Making North America series. And that middle block, we pried that block up live on television. I did not know there were palm fronds at this fossil site, and I nearly collapsed. I couldn't believe that I had the good luck to pop up a 50-million-year-old palm frond on a beach in Alaska.
So, okay, so how did a palm frond get to Alaska?
That's a good
point.
Was
it a very different climate? I mean, it must have been a very different climate than it is now.
Yeah, this is it. What we find again and again in the fossil record is that for much of Earth history, the polar regions weren't cold. They were warm. They were forested. And you find things like palm fronds and tapirs in Alaska or forests on Antarctica. So it really changes the way you think about planet Earth. Because today we think, oh, there's ice caps in the ends and it's hot in the middle, and animals and plants are distributed accordingly. Dial the clock back, there were times when there were no ice caps at all. So this is a really cool rock because it's just two words, Alaska and palm. And those two words don't go together, but they do on this fossil.
Are there certain parts of the country where you tend to find these kinds of bones in the U.S. or are there certain parts of the world where most of the fossils that are being found these days are found?
Yeah, fossils are pretty common all over the world, and they're found in places that used to be landscapes. And the world is mainly landscapes now, and as landscapes slowly subside, so places where landscapes are sinking, mud piles up and buries stuff. Later on, those same landscapes might rise back up and expose those layers of rock that have the fossils in them. So if you're in a place that used to be a low-lying landscape, that is now uplifted and exposed as rocky layers, you'll find fossils in almost everywhere. Almost every state, well, in fact, all states in the Union have lots of fossils in them.
Ooh, a bone I can touch.
There you go.
So this is a humerus.
Yes. You know what a humerus is? It's your bicep bone.
It's like the upper, from your elbow to your shoulder.
Whose humerus is this?
This is Brachiosaurus, which is a gigantic sauropod. These are animals that might be about 20 feet high at the hips and maybe 40 feet tall at the top of the head. I mean, this bone is what? That's got to be at least
like
six feet long.
Yeah.
And heavy. I mean, if that was in rock, it probably weighs something like 600 or 700 pounds. One bone.
Wow.
One upper arm bone.
That is crazy.
And it's a vegetarian. It's a plant-eating dinosaur.
Lucky for me.
A lot of plants.
What did you think the first time you touched a dinosaur bone?
You know, I told you, I got into fossils by finding little ones. And I love finding little fossils. And the first dinosaur I touched, I must have been, as a picture of me touching a Triceratops. I don't remember that experience. But when I was 22, I was out looking for fossil plants in North Dakota. And I found a Triceratops skull sticking out of the ground. I saw the horns sticking out of the ground. And that's the first time I had a dinosaur moment. I was like, oh my God, I just found a dinosaur. And that was amazing because I think there is a thing about finding a fossil. Like you're walking along out in the desert and you're hot and sweaty and you're looking for something else. And there's a Triceratops sticking out of the ground. That blew my mind. That's why Triceratops is my favorite dinosaur. I mean, T-Rex is really cool.
But you never forget your first.
Yeah, you never forget your first.
That was Kirk Johnson, director of the National Museum of Natural History, touring us through its new dinosaur and fossil hall. Still to come, we'll come face to face with the ferocious new T-Rex in the exhibit, and we'll speak to the Montana rancher who discovered it back in 1988. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Let's get back to some highlights of our tour of the Smithsonian's new Deep Time exhibit with paleobotanist Kirk Johnson. He's the director of the National Museum of Natural History.
As we keep walking, let me ask you a little bit more about the background of the exhibit. How do you figure out what data to include in an exhibit like this in 2019, particularly now that more people are thinking about things like climate change and the warming of the earth? Like, how does that affect the way we look at the entire existence of life?
Well, we realize that we live in a time where we're actually paying attention to what's going on in the planet. Like, is global warming a problem would be a question someone might ask. And we can look back in the Earth's history and say, well, what, has it been a problem in the past? Are there examples when it was warmer than it is today? If so, what did it look like? And one of the lessons about climate that's pretty remarkable is that for 75% of the last 500 million years, there has been no ice on the poles. Like, you go to the poles today, you get Antarctica with 2 miles of ice, you get Greenland with 2 miles of ice. Dial the clock backwards to 40 million years ago, there were forests on Antarctica and Greenland. So we can look back in time and see evidence of situations that we might encounter in the future.
How do you walk away from an exhibit like this if, say, you are not sold on the science behind climate change, or if your religious views question the existence of dinosaurs or define them as existing thousands of years ago rather than millions of years ago? How do you view an exhibit like this?
If you have religious views or political views, you're going to have to square them with scientific views as well. And there's sort of three levels of viewing. So people come in here with all sorts of beliefs, and we welcome everybody to the museum. What we're presenting here is the scientific record of our planet. So it's just data. And you don't have to believe science for it to be true.
It has to get a little sticky for a federal museum to kind of deal with so many people with so many different politics and views.
I don't really think so. I mean, I think we are a science-based nation. And so if we present purely scientists, we're not making statements like, you must believe this, or you must achieve this policy. We're saying, here's what science tells us about planet Earth.
Talk about how the exhibit deals with some of the uncertainty around paleontology, new fossil discoveries. There's this Tanis site in North Dakota. There was a New Yorker article about it in March, and this disagreement as to whether it contains evidence of an asteroid that killed off the dinosaurs. How do you deal with that kind of ambiguity or an unresolved question?
So paleontologists are really good with ambiguity because we're looking at things that happened a long time ago, and sometimes you might say, well, this fossil is 40 million years old plus or minus a million years. That's a lot of ambiguity, plus or minus a million years.
That's a range.
Yeah, it's a pretty big range. But what we do then is like, okay, here's the uncertainty. It's plus or minus a million years. Can we work on that? Can we get better data and push it down to plus or minus 10,000 years? And that's what scientists do in general, is they build hypotheses, they test them, and they get it increasingly better and better constrained view of what happened on planet. So that site in North Dakota that you mentioned, we learned in 1980 that an asteroid struck the planet, and the idea was, did this asteroid actually cause the extinction of the dinosaurs? Lots of debate about that between 1980 and 1988. By 1988, most of the scientists in the world were like, yeah, there's actually enough evidence. We find this layer from the debris from the asteroid all around the world. The dinosaurs are right below it, never above it. And not only that, but other kinds of animals and plants show the same pattern of extinction exactly at the level where we find the evidence of the asteroid struck. So that went from being a crazy idea to being settled science in a matter of a decade as more and more people studied it. And that's what science does. It always challenges, it's always testing, and you repeat your observations, you get the same observation multiple times, you start to say, hey, this might actually be real.
A bunch of our listeners wanted us to ask about the funding for this hall, because it's funded by $35 million that was given by David Koch. Mm-hmm. It's called the David H. Koch Hall of Fossils. Right. Some of our listeners kind of questioned a right-wing philanthropist, a guy who made his money in petrochemicals, funding this kind of an exhibit. What would you say to them?
Well, first of all, the Smithsonian, we do get a lot of our funding for exhibits from private individuals. What we don't do is we don't allow those individuals to define any aspect of the content of the exhibit. There's a bright red line between what we put in the exhibit and what the funders believe, think, or feel. Obviously, someone giving money to the exhibit has reasons to do that, and I believe that David Koch is a very positive person towards science in the support he's given to us and to NOVA, to our Human Origins Hall. He supported basic science, and I can tell you that he had no impact on the content of this exhibit. If you go through it, it's a very hard-hitting exhibit about how climate has changed through Earth history and how it impacts us now and possibly into the future. So I can see probably people would ask the question, but there's a very clear line between what a donor does and what the museum does. And we do our content entirely within the museum.
So he basically gave the money and backed off.
That's right.
Okay, so I want to see the big one.
Okay.
Can we please? Like,
we
I want to. I'm trying not to be a 12-year-old. I'm like, I want to see the big one now.
Well, we have several big ones, it turns out.
You know which big one I'm talking about.
All right, you want T-Rex,
yes,
I assume.
Yes, go.
Don't you want to see Diplodocus on weighted
dinosaurs? I want to see the big one.
Okay, we're going to the T-Rex.
We'll look at all the other stuff later.
I think you are behaving exactly like I hope many of our visitors will behave. It's like the door
opens. I want to see the big
one. It's a full sprint to the big one. The big one is in view. There he is.
Wow.
So you are looking at a complete skeleton of Tyrannosaurus Rex, this massive meat-eating carnivore that is 40 feet long. His hips are 12 feet off the ground. His head's 5 feet long. He's got teeth the size of railroad spikes.
Wow.
And he is having lunch. And his lunch is a Triceratops.
Yeah, that's an unlucky trike there.
Yeah, it is a very unlucky trike. Now, what's cool about this one, this is a skeleton that was found in Montana in 1988 by a rancher. This woman, Kathy Wankel, was hiking. And she found that bone, see the little arm bone there? Mm-hmm. You've heard that Tyrannosaurus rexes have small arms. See that forearm? That forearm is smaller than your forearm. See the radius and the ulna?
Yeah.
His fingers are bigger than your fingers, but the radius and the ulna are smaller than your arm. Now, you're a big guy, but you're not 40 feet long.
No.
She took that bone to the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman, Montana, and the paleontologist there nearly fell off his chair because no one had ever found that bone on a Tyrannosaurus rex ever before. And he knew what it was because they'd found the adjacent bones. So they know what it should look like. He's like, take me back to where you found that bone. And they went back to that spot. 6 months of digging later, this entire skeleton was unearthed on the banks of the Fort Peck Reservoir.
So, wow. So is this, did they find the entire T-Rex or did you have to like fill in some gaps?
We filled in gaps. And on every one of the labels, if you slide over here to the label, you can see in white the stuff that is real fossil and in gray the stuff that's filled in. So we're missing most of the back end of the tail. We've got one real vertebrae at the back end there. The skull is, they did find parts of the skull, but we had a cast of the skull here because the way we're mounting it, if that was the real skull, we'd be endangering a very valuable artifact. So there's that. But you can see that the forearms, all of the back vertebrae are there, the hips, both legs, both arms. It's a very complete skeleton of a gigantic carnivore that lived 67 million years ago.
So from when she found the first part of this to now, it's been like 21 years?
Yeah, maybe a little bit more than that even.
31 years. Yeah. Arithmetic went out the window as soon as I saw this thing. Now, you have this T-Rex kind of chomping on the back of a Triceratops' head, which, you know, life's tough. But there's a larger debate behind the orientation of the T-Rex and the trike that has to do with the nature of the Tyrannosaurus Rex, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. There's a debate, and I don't think it's much of a debate, but the idea is everybody assumed when they first found Tyrannosaurus Rex back in 1904 that this was clearly a carnivore. This is like an animal that would go out and kill you without even thinking about it. Cold-hearted killer. But later on, Jack Horner, who was the paleontologist at the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman and also one of the guys they made Jurassic Park about, he said, I actually think T-Rex was a scavenger, more like a hyena or a vulture. It's an animal that didn't walk around and kill things. It walked around and ate dead things. So if you think about that, looking at this, this could be either, right? This could be a T-Rex that just killed and is about starting to eat a Triceratops, or it could be a T-Rex that's walking along and just found a dead Triceratops. And there's nothing about this mount that helps you know which is which.
Because we don't know.
Well, it turns out that we probably do know. There have been a couple of cases where, and for this, see that animal over there? That's an Edmontosaurus, a duck-billed dinosaur.
Uh-huh.
There have been a couple of Edmontosaurus, duck-billed dinosaurs found with T-Rex bite marks on their tail that have rehealed.
You're talking about this big, kind of this taller one behind the T-Rex.
Yeah. So now imagine if you were a T-Rex and if you bit the back end of a duck-billed dinosaur that was alive and the duck-billed dinosaur got away and it rehealed, that would be evidence that the T-Rex was trying to eat you when you were alive, as opposed to finding a bite mark that didn't reheal.
But it could be both, couldn't it? It could be a predator and a scavenger?
Sure, and I think that's, of course, most predators are scavengers. I mean, most predators will eat anything that comes along, dead or alive. They don't care. They just want food. But to say something's only a scavenger is almost sort of a misleading phrase in my own view of the world. So I think that what you have here is a predator who would eat anything it wanted, whenever it wanted.
Why am I suddenly 13 years old right now? Like, this is amazing. I've never seen anything like this.
See, and you haven't been to this museum in how long?
I'm a fifth grade safety patrols okay. In elementary school. All but right. This is, like, viscerally incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it about dinosaurs that just makes people wow at these things?
I can't understand that. Why everybody is not that way about it, but we know that kids go nuts about dinosaurs, and we don't really even know why. I mean, kids get lots of dinosaur toys and lots of dinosaur books, but I've met kids that can name 400 dinosaur names. I mean, this is a serious disease amongst children called dinomania. And I love it because those are our people. The kids are our people.
So this T-Rex, I'm just trying to kind of describe what I'm seeing. Yeah. So we've got... And I mean, it's in an enclosure that kind of stretches out. The tail is stretching out beyond the enclosure. And then this poor Triceratops is kind of laid out on the side waiting for help.
Yeah. Help's not coming.
Help is not coming. The help is what, like 65 million years late?
Exactly.
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Can I share one question from a listener? Candace
Please.
Wrote on our Facebook page, what is the most dramatic change you've seen in a species?
In a species, that's an interesting question because it could imply a rapid burst of evolution or it could apply a rapid extinction. And I'll say one thing, if you see that great big stone over there next to the head of the Edmontosaurus, the most dramatic thing that I think has ever happened on planet Earth was it happened 66.02 million years ago when a 6 mile diameter rock hit the Earth at the speed, 20 times the speed of a rifle bullet. Punched a hole that was 20 miles deep, caused an explosion that was the equivalent of a billion Hiroshimas, and caused the extinction of all large animals on the planet. That was an abrupt event. So if you want an abrupt event, that's it. That happened in 2 seconds, but it happened a long time ago. So just remember, things that happened a long time ago don't necessarily take a long time to happen.
Can we go back over to the T-Rex?
Yeah, of course. Okay. Perfect. You're showing the right kind of behavior here.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Well, and I also wanted to ask you, you know, about the acquisition of these fossils. You know, we've been learning more about this kind of illicit trade in fossils and dinosaur bones. There's a T-Rex for sale right now on eBay for, I think, like $3 million. Mm-hmm. You know, we did a piece about the Museum of the Bible here in D.C., and we talked to them about the provenance of some of the artifacts they have. They've taken down some that they learned were looted or were inauthentic. How do you deal with that in paleontology, especially because technology makes it easy to say, hey, I've got a fossil for the highest bidder?
Yeah, so basically in this country, United States is the one country in the world that has a lot of dinosaurs where it is legal to sell dinosaurs as long as you've collected them on private property. So in this country, if they're on federal property, they're owned by the government. But if you're a private property owner in Montana and you find a T-Rex in your backyard, it's yours. Which means if you have it, you can sell it. So we have a legal market in dinosaurs in this country. And of course, there's a legal market in fossils as well, but from private property. And the question comes down is, has someone looted a fossil from federal land? Has someone illegally imported a dinosaur from Mongolia, where all the dinosaurs are owned by the country, not by the individuals? So that's the question of that. It's sort of like the antiquities thing. Some antiquities are legal and some are not. And it's important to know which laws apply where.
Did the museum have to pay for this T-Rex?
No, we got this on loan from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. It was found on federal land managed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And they had it stored at the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman. And they had two T-Rexes from the same place. And we politely asked them to borrow one of them. And they said, well, yes, you can borrow our T-Rex because we're both part of the federal government. If you look up at the tail of the T-Rex, what do you notice about the brackets?
Well, the first thing I notice is that they're brackets. They're not driven through the bones.
But do all the bones have them or just some?
No. I can see a bracket that's like 20 or 25 sections off the tail, and then there's another one about 9, 10, and then there's a string of brackets.
Yeah.
So they're not all bracketed
on
the sides.
So what you're seeing is those careful brackets, like the things that would bracket a stone onto a ring. Every time you see a bracket, you're looking at a real fossil bone. Every time you don't see a bracket, you're just looking at a cast or a reproduction of the bone. So the skeleton is not totally complete, but the rare fossil bone, we use those brackets to basically clasp the bones in place.
Now this is kind of different from some of the other fossils that I've seen where they might like drill it or, you know, they'll go through the bone to hold them together and post them.
And we don't want to do that because this is a rare fossil. So our idea is to build this very beautiful, elegant clasp that clasps the bone firmly and holds it in place so that the bone is protected. But when we have a cast, we just drill a hole in it. It's just made of plaster. And so you can see on that thing where the tail, there's only that one vertebrae in the tail that's real for the back part of the tail. And then you get into this part of the body where everything is real all the way up to the neck. And that's what's so cool about this animal is you learn to read what's real on it by looking at the label or by looking at the bracketing. And you look really realize you got a real treasure here.
For people who've seen other exhibits with dinosaurs, what makes this one different from whatever else people may have seen?
This exhibit is actually unique in the sense that, first of all, it's not just dinosaurs and not skeletons. It's all life forms, plants, insects, algae, the whole gamut. Anything that's alive on planet Earth is in this exhibit. Second is the story starts at the beginning of the Earth, and it doesn't end in the past. Most fossil exhibits are about fossils, so they end some number of years ago. They usually end in the ice ages. Now, if something ends before you got there, is it relevant to you or not? We said, yeah, what we want to do here is make this exhibit end not in the past or even in the present, because the present's a losing game, right? The present stops tomorrow, like we closed it in 2019. Next year, it'd be out of date already. So we're going to end this exhibit in the future. The exhibit actually goes into the future and asks you, the visitor, to imagine what's going to happen in the next century. With the booming human population, increased encroachment of humanity on biodiversity and wilderness places. What's going to happen in 20 years or 40 years or 60 years? What can you do as a human to impact a positive future for planet Earth, both for humanity and for the wild world?
Mind blown. And by this exhibit, Kirk Johnson, thank you so much for walking us through this. This is incredible.
Hey, fun interview. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Cheers, man.
That was Kirk Johnson, who led this renovation at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History, giving us a tour of the new Dinosaur and Fossil Hall unveiled in Washington. Today's show is part of our partnership with Smithsonian Magazine. You'll find more on the exhibit at smithsonian.com/deeptime, and you'll find much more about their work on our website, the1a.org. Coming up, we'll meet the rancher who found the T-Rex that's in this new exhibit. She was camping with her family on Labor Day back in 1988 when she saw something unusual in the dirt. That's just ahead. Stay close.
Something like a monument. I'm a dinosaur. Somebody's digging my
Back to our conversation in a moment after we give you a quick heads up about a series that's coming next month. We asked you what shows you wanted to hear in the new year. We collected the pitches, put them on our website, you voted on your absolute favorites, and now we are ready to deliver. So, every Thursday next month, we'll produce a special listener-picked show. From how to regulate homeschooling, to the spread of corporate healthcare, we'll put your questions to the experts and hear what they have to say. That all starts January 2nd here on 1A. Back now to our conversation on dinosaurs in partnership with Smithsonian Magazine. We just toured the new Fossil Hall at the National Museum of Natural History, and the star of that exhibit is a full-size skeleton of a Tyrannosaurus rex. It had a wild journey from Montana to Washington, and author Paige Williams is here to tell us all about it. She's the author of The Dinosaur Artist: Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for Earth's Ultimate Trophy. Paige, before we hear from the woman who found this T-Rex that we just geeked out about, I'd like to get your perspective on the exhibit and what makes it special.
Well, it's long awaited. It's been in the works for years now, and a great vision and expense by Kirk Johnson and his team, and the Smithsonian overall. And it's spectacular. I have not seen it yet. I've seen it behind the scenes. I don't know if Kirk will kill me for saying this or not, but he showed me the T-Rex eating the trike one night after I think we had an appearance in D.C. To talk about the book, and it was incredible. And everything that I've seen online so far and on video just makes me eager to get there and to see it in person. The walkthrough that you just had with Kirk was stunning. I was able to get to the studio a little bit early and hear a part of that, and what a treat.
It was. It was indeed. And we also had the distinct treat of meeting Kathy Wonkel, who is the woman who discovered the T-Rex fossils that are on display in this new exhibit. She and her husband are ranchers in Montana. Kathy was in town with dozens of her family to celebrate the opening of the new Fossil Hall. We interviewed her as she was standing in front of the T-Rex at the Smithsonian, and she told us about when she went fossil hunting back in 1988 with her family over Labor Day weekend.
So my husband boated me across the bay, and we left the kids at camp with his brother. We docked the boat along the bank. He got out, and he was walking along the lower edge, along the waterfront, and I went up on the higher part of the ridge, and he said, "Kathy, I think I'm finding some little pieces. Come down and look." And I said, "You better come up here. I think I've really found something." And what was sticking out was probably 2 to 3 inch by 5 inches, but I could see that it was bone. It was a different color. I could see the bone matrix or the webby pattern of the bone, and there was a few flakes coming off of that. So I said, "I think I've found something big." And I knew there had been dinosaur fossils found in the area even since the early 1900s, when Barnum Brown and some of them came out to dig and take them back to New York or Chicago or the big Carnegie museums. So I thought, heck, I'm going to look for a fossil too, and just happened to hit the jackpot.
Indeed she did, but Kathy Wonkel told us she had never found a fossil before.
The shoulder blade that you see on this side of us, that long bone that goes around his rib cage, there was about 2 to 3 inch by 5 inches sticking out of the ground, the crest of the shoulder blade. The ulna bone, which is the smaller bone of the lower arm, had never been found before. So finding a bone that no one had ever found before is pretty cool. It was either beginner's luck or divine intervention, really. The bones maybe found me to get them out of the ground and get them mounted so they could tell their story. I don't know, you know, beginner's luck. I'd never found a whole bone before.
Well, she found a lot of whole bones, but it took weeks to dig them out and get them to a museum to be analyzed.
By the time we got the bones dug out of there. It took us 3 or 4 weekends to go up there. It was in hard gumbo, which is clay, gray mud. And because of the drought, it had baked hard as concrete. We took the bones home, and then at Thanksgiving, I had contacted the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman and knew they had the expertise. They had a triceratops from our same area that they had excavated. So I just knew that if I had called them up and said, I'm a ranch woman from... I'm a ranch woman from eastern Montana, and I think I found a dinosaur bone. They probably would not have, they get a lot of people bringing different things in there. So we brought the bones to them at Thanksgiving, and they knew right away it was a meat-eating dinosaur from the density of the bone marrow. And they knew right away it was a T-Rex forearm, and they said, Can you show us where you found these? And we said, sure. And they just asked us to keep the site a secret.
Now, the Museum of the Rockies dug the skeleton out and displayed it first in Bozeman, Montana. But Kathy Wankel does admit she did not do everything above board.
We didn't really think we were doing anything wrong by digging them up and taking them to a museum. Actually, we had done something wrong. We should have notified someone and they came out there. But like I said before, I just didn't think anybody would come and take me seriously that what I had found. So we did get a letter from the Corps of Engineers saying what we did was the right thing, take it to the museum. But technically what we had done was a little not, according to the law.
That was Kathy Wankel, the Montana rancher who found the Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton that is now on display at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. Paige Williams, how common is it for amateurs like Kathy to find something this significant?
That conversation with Kathy is amazing. I've never heard her talk about that. I actually didn't know that that was her first fossil. I thought she was a regular hunter who liked hiking and walking around and looking for material. But to realize that that was her first fossil and that she found a specimen with the first forelimb, T-Rex forelimb known to science, is stunning. That doesn't happen. That happens hardly ever. Fossils are common. They're found everywhere. And usually it's interesting that in your lead-in you talked about asking listeners to call in if they've dug for fossils. Usually you find them by walking around and looking down. Paleontologists are often asked whether they use certain technology to find fossils, and the guys almost always say, no, we just walk around and look down. It's as simple as looking for material that doesn't quite look the same as the rest of the rocks in the area or that has a bit of a different texture. So finding fossils is not unusual, but to find one like Kathy found is a stunning accomplishment.
Help us understand the rules, at least here in the U.S., in terms of who has the right to look for or own or collect fossils. What are the rules in America for that?
Yeah. Kirk talked about this a bit before we started talking, and he's absolutely, of course, right, that in the United States, this country is a bit different in that anybody who wants to go hunt for fossils can go hunt for fossils. As long as you are on property that you either own or where you have permission to collect, you can collect them. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter whether it's new to science. It doesn't matter whether there's only one of them in the world, on the planet. The laws are simply unlike anywhere else in the world. If the materials are on public property, that is to say property owned by the government, the federal government, taxpayers, you the people, we the people, they are not yours. They belong to American citizens. They belong to the government. So you can't, it's funny that Kathy was talking about having done, quote unquote, something wrong by digging out that specimen that became the nation's T-Rex. Yeah, technically somebody could have come along and arrested her and her husband for that, I think. Because it is against the rules and against the law to take something out generally, to take something out of a place like that.
We did get some calls from several of you across the country who told us about your experiences hunting fossils. Here are the stories of two people who claimed they found fossils. Here's what they left in our inbox.
My name is Zachary Stafford, and I'm from Belleville, Illinois. Through the geology department at my college at Westminster, I have spent most of my summers out in the Ogallala grasslands in Nebraska and the Dakota prairies, searching for fossils and bringing them back to my college for research. I am fortunate enough to have found multiple dinosaur bones as well as other large mammals from the Oligocene and the Cretaceous period for the dinosaurs. And I love it every single day I get to work with them.
My name is Jerry. I live in Mount Juliet, Tennessee. We recently bought a property here, and I've explored the woods and discovered Ordovician fossilized coral. I've started making jewelry out of it. They're just absolutely beautiful. When I lived on the western slope of Colorado, I explored the desert and canyons there and finally found my dinosaur. It was articulated vertebrae and ribs in a cliffside. I urge everyone to get out there and explore. There's fossils everywhere.
Yeah, Zachary and Jerry, thank you both so much for sharing your stories with us. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Paige, this particular story with Kathy seems like a win-win for everyone, but your book shows there's a real tension between academic scientists and many amateur and commercial fossil hunters. What's at the heart of that tension?
At the heart of that tension is our shared understanding of life on Earth and the history of life on Earth. And paleontologists love it that that hunters are out there looking, and that I don't think a lot of them are that jazzed that that hunters want to sell some materials, but they really want everyone to play by the rules and to follow the law and to not sell what could be important to science, or to not overly commercialize what belongs to all of us as humans living on the Earth.
Your book focuses on an American fossil hunter from Florida and a dinosaur specimen from the Gobi Desert in Mongolia. Tell us about that.
So this was an unprecedented federal court case in the United States. It was called the United States of America versus one Tyrannosaurus bitar skeleton. And essentially, the fossil hunter, a Florida hunter named Eric Procopi, a graduate of the University of Florida, young married guy, father of two with an engineering degree, who had spent his whole life hunting fossils for a living, mostly Ice Age megafauna in Florida, had decided, for reasons that I won't spoil, to go into dinosaurs. He needed to get into dinosaurs. And in this country, the dinosaur lands, the territory, the tracts where you might, the formations where you might find dinosaurs in the United States are usually either on federal property or they're tied up in private leases where one hunter or a collection of hunters have specific permission to work that outcrop or that that property. So he found an alternate source. Dinosaurs since the 1990s, the late 1990s, had been showing up at the big trade shows, at the big fossil and gem shows that happened in Tucson and Denver and Munich and in Tokyo. And these were dinosaurs sourced out of the Gobi Desert of Mongolia, which is illegal, but it appeared illegal to some of these hunters because they were showing up everywhere. So he began sourcing his materials from some of these trade shows and out of the Gobi Desert itself in Mongolia by making several trips.
Before we have to let you go, I do want to get a sense of the way that this should work. Elizabeth tweeted, I live in Michigan, and my favorite places to look for fossils is the shores of the Great Lakes, Superior, and Michigan. For the Elizabeths of the world, what are the rules for buying and selling fossils? Other than what happens on the black market, are there one or two key rules to keep in mind?
Well, it depends on where you are. So if you are on federal property, on public land, you probably should get to the nearest natural history museum or university with a good paleontologist, geologists, someone who can advise you on what you found and how important it is. I think that especially if you think you found something interesting or new, getting to the scientist is, I think, valid. I mean, Kirk would better answer this question, frankly. But
are there international rules, though?
There are, but it's hard to know what they are because the rules often change in other countries and they aren't necessarily publicized in English. They aren't available in English. And so sometimes it's impossible to know what the new standards are. And some of these rules, some of the laws change according to what political regime is in office, too. So it's almost impossible to know. If it feels shady, it probably is. If it feels like it's not quite right, it probably is.
And very briefly, how do museums like the Smithsonian ensure that they're not getting something that's been smuggled?
That's a really good question. That's one for Kirk also. I think that they are very careful about who they work with. They know a lot of these. For one thing, they dig their own materials or they source their own materials and go out themselves in the field. Kirk is always in the field. His team is in the field. So they do their own work. And then if they aren't doing their own work, then they're dealing with people that they know and that they trust and who have a really good solid track record in finding these stuff.
Paige Williams of The New Yorker. She's the author of The Dinosaur Artist. Her story on the national T-Rex is in the June issue of Smithsonian Magazine at smithsonianmag.com. Paige, thanks very much.
Thank you, Joshua.
Today's show was made possible thanks to our partners and friends at Smithsonian Magazine. You'll find more information about the new fossil exhibit at smithsonian.com/deeptime and find much more about their work on our website, the1a.org. This show was produced by Danielle Knight with assistance from Jake Cherry and Amanda Williams. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.